Well, thank you all for coming. We're going to try this evening to lay some groundwork as to what it is that we're wanting to accomplish through this series of Bible studies. I have decided to title the Bible studies Water of Life. As most of you know, we distribute living waters, the Gospel of John, in large quantities, and the name of our ministry is Message of Life. But we're trying to keep on the same theme. We have the Manna of Life for the basics class that we're running. As we get started, I'm going to set forth two theses, but the objective here is for us not to lose perspective. I have always enjoyed this cat. If you notice what's sitting on top of its binoculars, a bird, and it's looking for birds and doesn't see the one that's right in front of it. So we need to keep our perspective. I'll be addressing that momentarily. There are two underlying theses of the Water of Life classes that we're going to have. The first one is going to be our Bible study 1A for this evening, and it will be the shorter one. And it will be that the main harvest of Gentiles is over and done with. And right now we are in a stage of gleaning. I'm going to establish that. What this will do is say that there is major urgency for us to get the message of life out. All that people have to do is believe Jesus Christ for his promise of everlasting life. And they have it. It cannot be taken away from them. But we are in the final stages of God making this available through the church age. After we have completed that, we'll take a short break, and then we'll have lesson 1B. Despite the fact that we have urgency, I am going to say, don't twist anyone's arms. If we are talking with people and we end up twisting their arm, we end up pressuring, we can negate the good message that we have. And we're going to do an analysis of what is believing. Essentially, what we're going to do in future weeks is to carve out some of the issues that I regard as ones that make us less effective in communicating the message of life to people that we want to speak with. And so we're going to be clearing out some underbrush. We've spent time on the Gospel of John, both at Harvey Park, and then I know that Steve and others have been doing classes in the Gospel of John. In order for us to look at this first issue of we're in the stage of gleaning, we're going to look at Romans 11. But before we do that, I need to give an overview of history. Once again, don't lose perspective. This is a dispensational chart. This is an outline of biblical history. Now, you have a sheet similar to this within your notes. You'll notice that I have 1, 2a, 3 in parentheses, 2b, and a therefore sign. I regard the millennium as God's therefore. It's essentially how all of history is going to be pulled together. That period of time, that 1,000-year reign of Jesus Christ is going to be the solution to history within history. Let me make note of a verse that we have down here on the bottom. Ephesians chapter 1, verse 10 calls the millennium the dispensation of the fullness of the ages. That is, it is the dispensation which fulfills the ages. It is where all of history comes together during a 1,000-year reign of Jesus Christ that is yet future to happen here on planet Earth. Okay, let me now lead into this. You'll notice On the far right, we have eternity, and that is a separate category. Eternity is outside of history. History is the flow of time and space that we are now in. Notice point one, Gentiles. The main passage covering that is Genesis 1 through 11. Then Genesis chapter 12 through Acts 1 covers Israel. Then the church receives focus in Acts 2 through Revelation 5. Then in chapters 6 through 19 of Revelation, we have the tribulation, that 7-year period of time that will happen after the rapture. Then we have the 1,000-year millennium, that's Revelation 20. And Revelation 21 and 22 talk about the eternal state. So this is the flow of history through the Bible. As we go Genesis 1 up through Revelation 20, we are looking at the whole expanse of human history on planet Earth in time. Revelation 21 and 22 is the main passage in Scripture that is devoted to eternity, to that that happens after what is defined as time. Now, you have some notes here on the bottom of this page that will help to give a bit of a picture on this. God administers history on the basis of promises that he has made. And so in period 1, 2a, and 3, we, by the way, are in the church, we are in period 3. God has made specific promises. In period 1, Genesis 1 through 11, God made promises to the whole human race. As for instance, there never will be a worldwide flood ever again. God made that promise to all of humanity in Genesis chapter 9. There are other promises in that section. For example, seed of woman was going to come in order to deliver man from sin and death. That was a promise made to all of humanity. Then in Genesis chapter 12, God created a brand new nation. That is the nation Israel. And all the way from Genesis 12 through Acts 11, Acts chapter 1, God makes promises specifically to Israel. But as he makes those promises, does that mean that he's forgotten about the promises that he made to all of humanity? Absolutely not. So what we have is God made promises to all of humanity, but then he made specific promises starting in Genesis chapter 12 for Israel, saying, for example, that through them the Messiah would come, that the Messiah would reign over the whole earth with Jerusalem as his capital. That's the millennium. God made promises to Israel specifically, but did not forget about the promises he made to all of humanity. Now, as you look at that chart, you'll notice that number 3 is shaded a little bit, right? And you also notice that it has parentheses around it. That's because if you look at the Old Testament, you won't see anything about the church. It's a parenthesis in history. And it was not until God chose to reveal it after, essentially, the church came into existence that he was making a new set of promises specifically to believers in Jesus Christ in what is called the church. And it's a mystery.
It's called a mystery.
Let me explain the word mystery. Mystery in the Bible refers to a previously unrevealed truth. So what happens? At this stage in history, God has made promises to the whole human race. He has made promises specifically to Israel, and he has made promises to us in the church. And God keeps all of his promises. Notice that I put 2a and 2b. The reason that I did that is because Israel continues. Notice the arrow across that parenthesis, across the church. So when the church is taken up in the rapture, God returns to the last 7 years of dealing with Israel directly. And that's called the tribulation. Then he comes, second advent. He destroys all of his enemies. He sets up his 1,000-year kingdom. And guess what he does? He fulfills all the promises he made to all of humanity. He fulfills all the promises that he made to Israel. And he fulfills all the promises that he made to the church. That is why we call it the culmination of history. It's the therefore. All of history is aiming towards that millennial kingdom. God will keep his promises. That is why, as we noted, Ephesians 1:10 calls that period of time the dispensation that is the fullness of times or fullness of ages. It is the time that fulfills all the promises God has made. Okay, I assume that this chart may be new to some of you. Am I correct?
Yes.
Okay. Don't worry about all of the specifics on it. We will be coming back to this. But in order for us to understand Romans 11, we need to have particularly a picture of how God works between Israel, the church, tribulation, and millennium. That's the part of it that we're going to see developed in Romans chapter 11.
So hey, John, could you just maybe touch on, because some people may go to a church that has covenant theology.
Sure.
And just be understand the difference between these two so everybody can understand.
Okay, very good. The type of theology that Steve referred to is called amillennial. And a means not, like in the word atheist. Atheist would be not a theist, someone who doesn't believe that there is a God. Amillennial is a view that says there will not be a millennium. There will not be a literal kingdom for Israel yet future. Now, Revelation 20 is a major passage on that. It's the only one that tells us the length of time. It's the only passage that says that that will be 1,000 years. But throughout the Bible, we have evidence that there will be that kingdom yet future. So Revelation 20 is the place that we find out that it's 1,000 years. But a lot of people don't really like the idea of Israel being reestablished because they like to say God wrote Israel off. That, yeah, God made some promises to Israel, but Israel is so bad that God wrote them off and he's not going to do anything with them, and we're the beneficiaries of everything God's going to do. But in order to say that, they have to maintain that God is, shall we say, not truthful. They say instead that, well, he said literal land, but he meant it spiritually. He really meant heaven when he said earth. And they have to do a lot of strange things in order to get around that. Has that covered what you
were? I think, yes.
Okay, very good. We're going to look at a major passage that will establish a lot of what I've talked about. I wanted to kind of say what I was going to talk about first before we got into it. So let's now look at Romans 11. But before we get there, I'll tell you what Romans 9, 10, and 11 are about. Romans 9 says that God is faithful to Israel despite its horrendous past failures. God didn't ever write them off. Romans chapter 10 says that even though Israel is failing right now and it's almost entirely in unbelief, God remains faithful to them. He has not written them off and will not. And Romans chapter 11 says there will be future failures. And despite the future failures, God remains faithful to Israel. He made promises to them. He will keep them. Because the nature of the promises that he made, he said that nothing could cause those promises to be broken. God made promises that will be kept.
I have a question.
Yes.
Is the promises from the Genesis for the land seed blessing?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Back in Genesis chapter 12, God told Abraham, or Abram as he was then known, I'm giving you land, seed, and blessing. And the way that he set it up, that was guaranteed. No matter what happened, God will fulfill those promises.
And it was almost like a marriage covenant, right? It was like a
covenant. Yeah, the covenant was set through with a very strong legal ceremony. Okay. Now, as you can see, I was not an art major. That on the lower right is an olive tree stump and has a branch. And the branch got broken off, and then grafted into it was another branch. And then that branch will get broken off, and another branch was grafted into it. That is making exactly the same point as this top chart that is an excerpt from that chart that I showed you on the previous slide. Notice we have Israel, the church, the seven-year tribulation, and the thousand-year millennium. And as you look at the olive tree, what do you see? Israel, church, tribulation, millennium. Okay, let's turn to Romans chapter 11. And I'll just start reading here in verse 1. I say then, has God cast away his people? Isn't that exactly the question that Steve was raising? Has God made promises that he plans to keep to Israel, or has he forgotten about them? Certainly not. For I also am an Israelite of the seed of Abraham, of the tribe of Benjamin. God has not cast away his people whom he foreknew. Or do you not know what the scripture says of Elijah? How he pleads with God against Israel, saying, Lord, they have killed your prophets and thrown down your altars, and I alone am left, and they seek my life. But what does the divine response say to him? I have reserved for myself 7,000 men. By the way, that word for men is males only. Guess what that means? There probably are a whole bunch of women and children that also were reserved by the Lord to him as well. So there's more than 7,000 who have not bowed the knee to Baal. Even so, at this present time, now during the church age, there is a remnant within the nation Israel, according to the election of grace. He's saying there still is a remnant. There still are people that God can work with in Israel, despite the overwhelming rejection by the nation. Okay, let's drop down now a little further into the chapter, and we'll start reading at verse 11. I say then, have they, that is Israel, stumbled so that they should fall? Certainly not. For through their fall, to provoke them to jealousy, deliverance has come to the Gentiles during the church age. So he's saying Israel stumbled over Jesus Christ. It doesn't mean that they fell permanently, but their stumbling has given opportunity for God to work with Gentiles. And can you imagine what Jewish people will think as they start reflecting on, here are all these Gentiles that are worshiping our God. How is it that we missed the boat? And that is designed to provoke them to jealousy so that they once again return to the Lord. And when they do return to the Lord, which they will, God will fulfill the promises that he has made to the nation. So Paul then says in verse 13, for I speak to you Gentiles, inasmuch as I am an apostle to the Gentiles. I magnify my ministry, if by any means I may provoke to jealousy those who are of my flesh, that is fellow Jews, and save some of them. For if they're being cast away, and the church coming into existence, is the reconciling of the world, what will their acceptance be but life from the dead? He's saying if God was able to work out good when Israel failed, can you imagine what God will be able to do when Israel succeeds? For if the first fruit is holy, the lump is also holy. And if the root, and he's going to start talking about an olive tree, if the root of the olive tree is holy, so are the branches. And if some of the branches were broken off, and a lot of people think this is talking about individuals, it is not. It's talking about the breaking off of Israel to put in the parenthesis to have the church in this period of history. If some of the branches were broken off, and you, being a wild olive tree, were grafted in among them. See where we've got the first graft on the tree. You were grafted in among them, and with them became a partaker of the root and the fatness of the olive tree. Do not boast against the branches. Against the branches. What he's saying is, you Gentiles really owe a debt of gratitude to Israel, so don't be looking down your nose at Israel and saying, oh, they are a real failure. Whew. I'm glad I'm not part of them.
Isn't
saying,
that what covenant theology is?
That's what covenant theology does. So he says, but if you do boast, remember that you do not support the root, but the root supports you. You will say then, branches were broken off that I might be grafted in. Well said. Because of unbelief, they were broken off. And you stand by faith. Do not be haughty, but fear. For if God did not spare the natural branches, he may not spare you either. There's going to be a point in time where the church will be cut off via the rapture. And the tribulation begins, which will then enable going into the millennium. So then what he says from there, verse 21, for if God did not spare the natural branches, he may not spare you either. Therefore consider the goodness and severity of God. On those who fell, severity, but toward you, goodness, if you continue in his goodness. Otherwise, you also will be cut off. And they also, if they do not continue in unbelief, will be grafted in. For God is able to graft them in again. For if you were cut out of the olive tree, which is wild by nature, and were grafted contrary to nature into a cultivated olive tree, Israel, how much more will these, who are natural branches, be grafted into their own olive tree. He's saying it's a lot easier for God to put Israel back in place than it was for him to put you in their place temporarily. So then he says, "For I do not desire, brethren, that you should be ignorant of this mystery, previously unrevealed truth, lest you should be wise in your own opinion, that blindness in part has happened to Israel." Not a total blindness. There are Jewish believers. But there is a partial blinding that has happened to them during this, the church age. How long will that partial blindness last? Until the fullness of the Gentiles has come in. In other words, God is saying here for the church age, there is a certain number of Gentiles that he's planning to harvest. Now the question becomes, when does the fullness come? Glad you asked. That was a good question. I think that Luke chapter 21, verse 24, which is talking about related things, is helpful. That passage says that Jerusalem will be trampled by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. Times of the Gentiles is the period in history where God has a focus on Gentiles. That's a good portion of the church age. All the way from Genesis chapter 12 up until Acts chapter 1, he was focused on Israel. He will again focus on Israel starting in Revelation chapter 6. But meanwhile, we're in the church. And during the church age, there is a focus on Gentiles. Now, what is fascinating about the Luke 21:24 passage, Israel did not have sovereignty over Jerusalem. It wasn't part of their territory. It was part of the territory of Jordan, a Gentile country, until June the 7th, 1967, during the Six-Day War. The fullness of the Gentiles had ended back then. The fullness of the harvest, the main harvest, is over and done with of Gentiles. They say, well, what's God been doing since 1967? Well, right now is the time of gleaning. For those of you that were in my Ruth series, after the harvest, the farmer was supposed to leave the corners of his field so that the poor people could go in and glean. And they would just be there picking up that which dropped in the process of doing the harvest. That's our period of history. Between now and when God chooses to end the church age, which is at his discretion, we can't predict the time. We're involved in just picking up the little scraps. Now, when I look at that, it gives me great urgency. That says the whole purpose for the church right now is to bring in a few grains of believers from among the Gentiles. The main harvest is over. We're just out there picking up the little grains that fell in the process of the harvest. Now, if God allowed 2,000 years for the main harvest, somehow I don't think he's going to allow a very long time for gleaning. What do you think?
John, what's the point where the full harvest is over and the gleaning begins? I'm not clear on that.
Okay. God viewed history from a Gentile standpoint, the times of the Gentiles, up until he allowed Israel to take sovereignty over the entire city of Jerusalem.
So 67.
67.
Okay.
And so what we're looking at is just the leftovers of harvest. That's what we're in right now. This is not the time to be expecting that there are going to be big crusades and massive conversions. This is going to be the time where what needs to be happening is for believers to be ministering to other people individually, out there gleaning the grains.
So we're all, some of us are products of the gleaning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, do you see why I look at this with urgency? I mean, God had this big plan, and as we look back over history, we're looking at the harvest. And now we're in a whole new era, one that I don't think is going to last very long. We cannot predict the rapture. Passages all over the New Testament say we cannot date it. It's an absolute mystery. It's absolutely secret. God has not revealed that. At some point we can have a class on that. But let's see. What? There we go. So, implications of the gleaning era. God's harvest of Gentiles took 2,000 years approximately. Gleaning will be quick. Of course, we can't date the rapture. We have urgency to spread the message. This Bible study is not one where my objective is to fill your notebooks. This is one where I think that we need to have a proper perspective. A perspective that looks at the Word and then looks at the world and what God wants us to do. We need to be able to reach out to people. We have plenty of living waters. We'll be talking about a lot of issues here to make it so that we're more effective in communicating accurately the message of life. Now, this was the more technical part of what we're going to go through this evening. But I think that this is an important thing for us to have a picture of where we stand in history, because that tells us what we ought to prioritize. Any further questions?
John, would it be worth going through a couple of the verses in Daniel to understand why this is the end of the Gentile period or not?
Sure. Yeah, we can do that.
And then we have a little time, right?
Yeah. Let's go to Daniel chapter 9. Before we get there, I need to say that you'll run into a word in this translation that will say weak. But the word that is used there just means a unit of seven. It doesn't tell us if it's a unit of 7 days or 7 years. But within the flow of the passage, everything argues that it is years. In Daniel chapter 9, Daniel says that he was reading in the book of Jeremiah. And as he was reading, he observed that God said that the captivity that Daniel was part of in Babylon was going to last 70 years. And as a result of that, Daniel said, as he prayed to the Lord, is it possible that at the end of this 70 years, that's real close, that what you're going to do is fulfill all of your promises that you made to Israel. Remember in our chart, God made promises to all of humanity. He made promises to Israel. And Daniel is saying, is this the time? Are you getting ready to bring in the kingdom? And as he prays, he finally receives an answer. And here is God answering him in verse 24. 70 heptads, 490 years, because I take it that it's a heptad or a unit of 7 years. 70 heptads are determined for your people, for Israel, specifically Judah, the southern kingdom, and for your holy city, Jerusalem. God is saying, I have 490 years more of working with your city and your people to do the things that you just prayed about. These are the six things: to finish the transgression, to make an end of sins, to make reconciliation for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy with there being no more prophecies made, and to anoint the most holy place. These six things would launch millennium. And he says, sorry, Daniel, I have 490 more years of working with your nation and your city to accomplish this.
Not 490 years, but 490 years of working with Israel.
Yes, and there are going to be interesting clues in the passage. Let me make an illustration so that I can help to bring out the point that Steve has brought up. Imagine that someone went to university. They just graduated from high school and they went to university. And they attended university for 2 years and then ran out of money, got a job, got married, started having kids. And about 15 years later, all of a sudden, they want to get back to university. Is that 17th year of university? No. They will enter their third year. They'll be a third year student. In the same way, God says, I have 490 years where I'm focused on your city, Jerusalem, and your nation. 490 years concentrated on your people. I'll be working with your people for 490 years. But what ends up happening is that the 483rd year, there's a gap. And the passage tells us there's a gap. It's like the person that dropped out of school, got a job, got married, had kids, 15 years later came back to university. So there's going to be a gap after the 483rd year. And guess what? That's why the tribulation will be 7 years. Because that's going to be the last 7 years of dealing with Israel to get ready to bring in the millennial kingdom, the thousand-year kingdom of Jesus Christ. Okay. Now, verse 25. Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the command to restore and build Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. So it's saying you got 483 years between a certain decree that we can date it within a couple weeks of when that decree was made. And the very most interesting thing about it is the 483 years ended Palm Sunday, less than a week before Jesus was crucified. And look at what the passage says. Here it says, The street shall be built again, and the wall, even in troublesome times. And after the 62 weeks, that is, after the 7 plus 62, Messiah shall be cut off. That's a word for executed. And it was Palm Sunday that that prophecy, the 483rd year, was completed. But not for himself. And the people of the prince who is to come, that is Rome, shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. Now, there's something very interesting about this passage that's very easy to overlook. Wouldn't you expect him to say, there are going to be 483 years, and in the 484th year, Messiah will be cut off. And in the 484th year, the people of the prince who is going to come are going to come in and take over. It doesn't say that. It says, after the 62 weeks have ended, Messiah is going to be cut off. And after the 62 weeks have ended, or the 69 weeks, excuse me, the Romans are going to come in and destroy the city, AD 70. And then it's going to tell us about events later that happen in the 70th week, 70th Heptad. So what we have is, there are events that happen after week 69 is completed, but before week 70 begins. Notice how we've got a gap. It's like the person who went to university 2 years, dropped out for 15 years, returned, and he's not a 17th year student. He is a third-year student. God has 490 years of working with Israel. First part of that is what I call 2A in the chart, Israel itself. Then we have the parenthesis. The church was dropped in there, no warning, nothing in the Old Testament said that it was ever going to happen. And when the church ends with a rapture, God will still have 7 more years of dealing with Israel.
He dropped the church in mainly to make the Israelites jealous.
That's a major part of it.
The Jews jealous.
That's a big part of it.
Because they were messing up so much?
Yeah, they were not very attentive when the Messiah came. He was proving who he was, and they rejected him overwhelmingly. And God gave him a lot of chances. And finally he said, okay, plan B, something new, we'll come back to this a little later. Okay, any questions there on that? I would have to say that a lot of churches have no idea about the millennial kingdom, have no idea about how God is working in history. And if we don't understand something about history, we're going to have a hard time dealing with what the Bible says, because the Bible is rooted and grounded in history. What we are telling people when we urge people to believe in Jesus Christ for the free gift of everlasting life, our message is rooted in history. It's not out there. Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's now look at persuasion. What time is it?
7 o'clock.
Oh, okay. I can see that clock. Good. I don't wear a watch because I have lots of allergies to things on my wrists and stuff like that. So I usually use my cell phone, but it won't stay lit up the whole time. Okay, so now we're going to look at persuasion. What is it to believe? Now, there are three possible mindsets that Christians have. The first one, man number one, he sees the world, but he doesn't see the word. I mean, he's focused there on that a tall mountain off in the background, and he has lost sight of the work. And when we see churches that are social clubs and so on and so forth, that's a large part of what's going on. Man number three is focused on the Word. He's saying, I want to learn the Word. But isn't focused on ministering to the world from the Word. The balance that we are aiming at is one that understands that what God is saying in His Word is designed for us to be able to get the message out. It doesn't do very much good for us to know truth if the truth that we know stays bottled up because we have a focus only on the Word. The Word ministers to us and to the world through us. We're the ones that have the opportunity to pass out living waters and to talk to people about the Lord that a lot of other people simply will not have contact with. And each one of us has been given opportunities by the Lord, and it's the objective of this set of Bible classes to have us focused on the Word and the world in proper relationship. That the Word is supposed to affect our ministry to the world. Okay. I have a verse here that I'm wanting for us all to memorize. Notice we called this Bible study the Water of Life. In Revelation chapter 22, verse 17, that's almost the last verse of the Bible, not quite. And the Spirit and the Bride say, Come. And let him who hears say, Come. And let him who thirsts come. Whoever desires, let him take the water of life freely. Water of life is going back to a little different phrase with the same meaning back in John chapter 4. Living water, which is the message that gives life. And appropriately, these Gospels of John are called living water. So this is a phrase that means the same thing, but it's a little different wording. Now in this verse, Revelation 22:17, who's speaking? Who's supposed to speak?
Jesus Christ, the Bride.
The Spirit?
The Holy Spirit.
Holy Spirit, and then the bride is?
Jesus Christ.
Church.
Oh, church.
And then, he who hears. I have to say something briefly about he who hears. Back in biblical times, Bibles were extremely expensive. And so most of the time people didn't read, they heard. Because someone read it out loud. Most reading in the ancient world was done out loud. So he's talking about someone who is being read to, or in our case, we may hear or we may read the Word, either way. So the Holy Spirit and the church as a whole are saying to people, to unbelievers, come. And what are we supposed to do, we who read this book? Invite unbelievers. Come. What is it that they are to come to? Notice the second question, to whom do they speak? Who is being told to come?
Unbelievers.
Notice, he says, and let him who thirsts come. Jesus says about the water, the living water that he gives, the person who takes one sip of it never thirsts again forever. This is talking about unbelievers. Let him take the water of life freely. What is the manner in which one drinks the water of life?
Freely.
Why is the horse here? You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. We can compromise the message. We can have all the best intentions. But if we don't understand how believing works, we can end up compromising the message by twisting people's arms. The only way that people drink the water of life is to drink it freely, not to be shoved up against the trough like the horse that says, no way. Okay. We're going to show a little film, a portion of it. Many of you have seen a lot more of the film than we're going to be watching. What we have is a courtroom trial. And in this courtroom trial, we're going to see some things about how believing works and how it doesn't work. And so, at the end of this, we're going to be asking questions specifically. Do people decide to believe? And, you know, you're probably all familiar with a famous magazine and a famous radio program, both put out by a very famous evangelistic organization. And the question is, can anyone decide to believe? Is it possible for a person to decide to believe? What we're going to see here is there's going to be a young man who is on trial for having allegedly stabbed his father to death. At the start of the jury deliberations, the first ballot, only one juror, number 8, Henry Fonda, voted not guilty. But gradually more and more people became persuaded that the case had not been made, that the defendant was guilty. Did you see anyone decide to believe? Can you decide to believe that we are on the beach in Miami and it's summertime and that it's 1955 and that you know, those nice brand new cars that are running around? Can you decide to believe that? The reason we cannot decide to believe something is because deciding to believe is called make-believe. If we make ourselves believe something that we don't really regard as true, we have made-believe. The point when we have believed is the point that we are convinced that something is true. Lee J. Cobb, did he say, wow, I just really want to believe that the defendant is innocent. No, he wanted that boy to go to the gas chamber and take his son along with him. We cannot decide to believe something, because believing is like seeing. Do you decide to see? We can cover our eyes, but even when we do that, we still see some color. We cannot force ourselves to ignore that which we know to be true. People often speak about deciding to believe. And often people are challenged to decide to believe in Jesus Christ. If they don't understand the issues and don't see them as being true, they're not in a position to decide to believe it. And if they've already concluded that it's true, they have believed, so they can't decide to believe because they've already believed. There are many volitional moments leading up to the point that a person believes, but believing itself is not a decisional moment.
You know, I noticed something in the movie tonight, John, that I'd never seen before. When he was talking about prejudice, the order that they turned away from the table, sensitive they were to prejudice. So Klugman, he was first. The old man, who never is heard, he was second. The watchmaker, was third. And as they went along, each one that was more sensitive to prejudice was the next to say, I'm not listening to this anymore. Mm-hmm. I've never seen that before. Mm-hmm.
As you can tell, we've seen this film a fair number of times. Okay, I'd like for us to go to 2 Corinthians 4, and I find this to be an absolutely fascinating passage. It reinforces the concept of how we come to believe. And I find it an absolutely amazing passage. Paul says, but even if our gospel is veiled, and do notice that I have underlined the words for veiling and blinding in verses 3 and 4. But even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing, whose minds the God of this age has blinded. Now, how is it, what does he mean by saying blinded? Does he mean that their eyes have been removed? No, it's already defined by veiling. The type of blindness that it's speaking about is preventing information from coming in. So, if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing, whose minds the God of this age is blinded by veiling, by putting a veil over the eyes, who do not believe, and later we'll talk about the word lest, but from now on we're going to be looking at words that talk about light. Lest the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God, should shine on them. Then verse 6, for it is the God who commanded light to shine out of darkness. This is looking back to the book of Genesis and creation. Who has shone in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. Now you notice some more of my high quality artwork on the here. We have a veil through which a person can see, you know, sort of like sunglasses. And that's obviously not what's being spoken about. But the person is unable to see because the veil prevents light from penetrating. Now it's pertinent for us to look at the word lest. Note the highlighted word in verse 4, lest. Greek has eistame plus an infinitive. Literally, it means unto not. The idea is the God of this age veils the eyes in order that the light of Christ would not shine into their eyes. Now, my father had a very good friend. He was actually my father's first employer, but I didn't meet him until he was elderly. And during his working career, he was blinded. And so he switched careers and started doing woodworking. And when we went to visit him, there were saws and all sorts of things whirring in the basement. The lights were off. And his wife called down to him. He came up, and then he said, you want to come see my shop? And he flicked on the light switch for us. He didn't need it, but how much good does it do to put a veil over someone who is blind? It's not going to do a thing. You know what the funny thing about Calvinists is? They look at this passage and they say that God constitutionally blinded people, and they think the God of this age is God. You notice it's lowercase g. How would we determine whether it should be a capital G? Is it talking about God being the one who does this blinding or veiling? Or is it talking about the God of this age, meaning Satan? I've made an observation as I've studied the Bible, and there are passages where God does blind, but he blinds in a different way than Satan does. God blinds with an abundance of light. We had a lot of welding that went on there in my father's business. And you know, you'd see the arc and you know, quickly do what they called the Letourneau salute, and that to hide your eyes. The type of blindness that God gives is such an abundance of light that people find it painful and they turn away from it. But the kind of blinding that Satan likes to do is to prevent light from coming through. But you notice the top little diagram where it's an opaque veil, whereas down below it's sort of like sunglasses. I believe God is in the business of turning up the rheostat. And God can turn up the rheostat so brightly that it even shines through the thickest veil that Satan can put. But what I find very interesting is that word lust. What it's saying here is that if Satan were not putting veils over the eyes of unbelievers by getting unbelievers to say, oh, that Christianity stuff, that's silly, that's for old women and little kids, that's fairy tales. And you know, they make fun of it, and they say, oh, well, evolution is so scientific, and this Christianity stuff is a bunch of hokey. And they try to do all sorts of things to get people to look at it and to regard it as foolish. And once that happens, there's a veil. There are a lot of ways that veils are put. But God is in the business of, as it says here, turning up the light. He can make it so that the light can even shine through the veil. Does the person decide to believe? It's all of a sudden, hey, wait a moment. What the Bible says about Jesus Christ is true. He really is who he says he is. He really has to be able to give everlasting life. Who else could do this miracle? Who else could be raised from the dead and have over 500 people testify, be willing to go to court in his day? He rose. When we start looking at the evidence, God is able to make the light shine through with his word. You know, Isaiah 55 says that God's word does not return to him void without accomplishing what he sent it to do. His word is persuasive, and the Gospel of John is designed to make the case for Jesus Christ. You know, my words don't have a money-back guarantee. Sometimes they drop and hit the floor and they don't even bounce. But God's word is guaranteed to accomplish what he has sent it to do, whether it's sent for judgment or sent for blessing. When God seeks to prove who Jesus is and that he grants everlasting life, he, in the Gospel of John, has made the best case that could be made. Doesn't look like believing is a decision according to this passage, does it? It's a matter of the light being shining brightly enough that you can make it out and it's, oh, I get it, it's true. Believing is an aha moment. Believing is the point where we recognize truth. The unbeliever is blinded in the sense of light doesn't penetrate. But when God turns up the light, there's enough evidence to persuade of his truth. God's in the business of persuading. We don't need to twist the arm. It's God's business to persuade. Okay, any questions about that passage? Let's go to Acts 28:24. And we're going to divide up into four teams. Those of you at this table here will be team one. Those at the couches here will be team two. You'll be team three, and those at the counter will be team four. So you'll catch on. So A, B, C, and D. Now, the way that the passage reads is A and C. It said, some were persuaded by the things spoken, and... Some were persuaded by the things which were spoken, some disbelieved the things which were spoken. I had to abbreviate it slightly. The interesting thing about this is that the meanings of these, whether people are persuaded by what Paul spoke in his last sermon in the book of Acts, they were persuaded. Would it mean anything different if we said some people believed the things which were spoken? It's absolutely the same thing. We have a negative response, B. Some disbelieved the things which were spoken. But that could have been stated as D. Some were not persuaded by the things spoken. Okay, so we're going to do kind of a drill where I'll say A and D. So group A, you read your part. Group D, read your part. A? Some were persuaded?
Some were persuaded by the things that were spoken.
D?
Some were not persuaded by the things spoken.
Okay, C?
The opposite of disbelief.
Read
on the screen. So some believe the things spoken.
Right.
B?
Some disbelieve the things spoken.
Okay, notice this can be switched around a lot of different ways because believing equals being persuaded. Disbelieving equals not being persuaded. It's looking at it from the opposite standpoint. It's either looking at it from the standpoint of the persuadee or the persuador. But the concept here is that believing equals being persuaded. And earlier in the passage it says that Paul was persuading people, and as a result there were people who were persuaded or who believed. The Greek verb for to believe and the Greek verb to be persuaded are from the same root. Pistuo, to believe, and patho, to be persuaded. Same basic etymological root back in the history of the word. The moment that we are persuaded that something is true, that is the point that we have believed. So it isn't that we decide to believe something. It is that we are persuaded. The next verse, I think, will help us also. Romans chapter 4, verses 4 and 5. Now to him who works, the wages are not counted as grace, but as debt. But to him who does not work, but believes on him who justifies the ungodly, his faith is accounted for righteousness. What he's saying is that believing is not a work, because a work is something that incurs a debt. And imagine that the employer said to his employee who's there ready to put his card into the time punch clock, Bob, another weekly gift for your hard work. And Bob says, it's not a gift. You owe me all my wages. And that's exactly what Paul is saying here in Romans 4. If a person works, if he's an employee of God, if believing makes a person into an employee of God, then that person has put God in his debt. Can you imagine the creature putting God in his debt? It doesn't happen. Now, what God has done is God has put himself into debt, in the sense that God has said, the person who is persuaded of Jesus Christ's gift of everlasting life, I obligate myself to give that person everlasting life. But that's God obligating himself. Believing is not a work that we do. Instead, the one that's doing the hard work is the persuader. Look at the 8 signs that Jesus did in the Gospel of John. Who was doing the work? And people would look and they say, I can't explain it any other way except he is the Messiah. And when he speaks, it happens. And he made a promise that if I believe in him, he will grant me everlasting life. Jesus is the one that has done the work in that equation of persuading through his signs and through his work. And Paul right here says, it's not a work that we do, because in verse 5, but him who only works a little bit. No. But to him who does not work, but instead of working, believes on him who justifies the ungodly, his faith is accounted as righteousness. That is why it is a matter of grace when we believe. Because to believe something does not involve a work on my part, and I can't brag, oh, wow, I believe that. Wow. I have something. You know, if someone said that right there is called a telephone pole. Now, if I believe them, wow, I believe that. Wow, that's pretty astronomical, isn't it? Pretty astronomically stupid. There is nothing that we are doing that is meritorious when we believe. The one who has the merit is the one who persuades, and it is God who fundamentally has to persuade. He's the one that's doing the work. He's the one that gets the credit. Belief is not a work. It does not put God in our debt. That's why Ephesians 2:8 can say it is of grace. Now here is the single passage that is regarded as, by most people, the hardest one to get around. And I think it's child's play. In John 6, Jesus has fed 5,000 men plus women and children, and he walked across the sea while it was stormy and brought the boat to their destination at Capernaum instantaneously. And as he is in the synagogue in Capernaum, there are people that are having a discussion with him. And specifically, they wanted him to give them more food. And Jesus seemed a little reluctant, so they said, well, if you don't want to do it, maybe you can tell us how to do it. You know, if you don't want to make more loaves and fishes, just tell us how to do it and we'll do the work. So they said to him, what shall we do, Jesus, that we may work the works of God? Jesus said, this is the work of God, that you believe in him whom he sent. Now you can see how it is that people interpret this as a work that we do for God. I mean, that's easy to see how that interpretation has come. So the first view is that believing is a work that we do for God. Well, if that were the case, that would be kind of a problem with Romans 4, 4, and 5. Let me make a very small modification in the word, and I'll add an ing. This is the working of God that you believe. This is God working to enable belief. Because how was it that God worked? All the signs that we see in the Gospel of John. He's saying God is in the business of working at persuading. He's not saying, oh, there's a work that you can do. Because believing is fundamentally being persuaded. So persuasion as a work that is done by God, not believing as a work that we do for God. And so this passage is not challenging, in my opinion, at all. Now we will go to a final passage on this that has caused a lot of people difficulty. Have you ever heard people say that drawing here in this passage is God yanking a person, like pulling a sword out of a sheath, and he's forcing this person to believe? Well, I don't think that's what the passage is saying at all. I've excerpted a few words out of that, so I'll just read out of, so I didn't have enough space for every word of the text, so. Jesus said, "No one can come to the Father, or come to me, unless the Father who sent me draws him. And I will raise him up on the last day. It is written in the prophets, they will all be taught by God. Therefore, everyone who listens to the Father and learns comes to me." I'd like for you to notice what we call an inclusio. Come to me comes to me. And in both cases, it's connected with the Father. No one can come to me unless the Father draws him. But he says, everyone who has heard and learned from the Father comes to me. The way that God draws is by teaching. And the one who is taught, that is the one who learns, is attracted. Comes to Christ. And the coming to Christ, here's a reference to believing. Drawing is by means of teaching, by making truth clear. As people see that rheostat getting brighter and brighter and brighter, it's shining more and more light on Jesus Christ, and they say, wow, what he says is really true. He is who he says he is. He gives everlasting life just as he promises. Because what he says, he does. And the means of drawing is by teaching. Everything that's in the middle in this passage is explaining drawing. Drawing happens by being taught, by learning. I have the light bulb here at the bottom. Light attracts the God taught. But the ones who are paying attention to man's thoughts and are not interested in what God has to say are repelled by the light. And the passage, I think, is fairly straightforward. Any questions about any of the passages that we've covered?
So in this, is this even a chiasm, or is it just an inclusio?
It could be seen as...
Listen and learn, be the drawing.
Yeah, there's a chiastic structure. Chiasm means it goes in an X shape. The Greek letter chi is where that word gets its name. And so what Steve is saying is, come, come. And then the center elements are draw, taught, and learn. Notice what is happening in all these passages. God is in the business of making his truth clear. And as people listen to what God has to say, they are persuaded. The evidence gets more and more weighty in their opinion, and they are persuaded. The point that a person has become a believer in Jesus Christ is the point that they have believed his promise because of who he is and what he does. How do I know that I have everlasting life? Very simply. Jesus promised everlasting life to everyone who believed in him for it. I believe in him for it. He will keep his promise, therefore I have everlasting life. We don't need to have difficulties with assurance. And let me tell you, as we minister to people, even many people that would call themselves Christians, if you ask them, do you have everlasting life? Do you know that there is nothing that could sever you from Jesus Christ? You'll hear people say all sorts of things. Well, I hope that I'm good enough. I think so. I hope my good works outweigh my bad works. They'll say all kinds of things. But we can know that we have everlasting life because Jesus promised it to everyone who believes him for it. I often illustrate how the uniqueness of believing promises or believing a gift as opposed to believing any other kind of truth. My parents were married in 1935. As you can tell, they were rather old when I was born, and I was rather young when I was born. My father liked overalls, and he had a nickname, Jumbo, because he wore Jumbo brand overalls. He did not have a suit and was wanting to get married. So one of his older brothers, Ted, gave him a used Wellman suit of his own so that Dad could get married. And I have to tell you, my father had a couple of unique habits. He would never put paper money into a pocket. It always went into a billfold. And he never put coins into a pocket. They always went into a coin purse. What did go into his pocket? All of his little drawings as he was going to be repairing this machine or fabricating this or doing that. And his pockets would be full of all of his drawings. So one time, it must have been Easter, he was wearing that suit. And I think he was expecting that he needed to find a couple of his drawings. So he reached into the lapel pocket, and lo and behold, there was a piece of paper. But as he looked at it, it was a $20 bill. But that was 1935. That was a lot of money. But my father knew that he didn't put it there because if it were his, it would have gone into a billfold. It was a used suit. The suit had belonged to Ted. So he made a long-distance phone call to Detroit and said, Ted, there was something in the lapel pocket of the coat. And Ted said, I was wondering when you'd find it. My father's first content of faith, it's a piece of paper. Second content of faith, it's a $20 bill. Third content of faith, it's mine. The point when we have believed Jesus Christ for his promise of everlasting life is when we know we have everlasting life because he promised it to us. Let me just touch a couple of things. This may be a little hard to see, but it's some yarn or string. Pushing is not drawing. You can't push a string very well. It draws very nicely. God is in the business of drawing. We shouldn't be in the business of pushing. Drawing attracts people to believe. Notice the Palestinian leading his sheep. And there's our dog Kel with a little different paint job. And driving. Driving pushes people to make believe, not to believe. Implications. We have two theses. The fact that we are in the gleaning stage gives urgency to our message. It is urgent to give people opportunity to believe, but not to drive them. Driving may cause them to make believe. There are a lot of people who are challenged, for example, to walk an aisle, raise a hand, pray a prayer, do all sorts of things like that. Let me illustrate the problem in two ways by having two multiple choice questions. I'll give you the answers for playing Jeopardy. The answers for the first question are 4, 40, 400, 4,000. And the question is 2 plus 2. You know the answer before you could write it down or speak it. If you tell someone, raise your hand, walk an aisle, say a prayer, they may have already believed in Jesus Christ. And we're getting them mixed up by having them do something, and believing is not doing, it is being persuaded. So for the person who's already believed, we can complicate things for them and have them go back, say, I raise my hand. Does that mean I'm going to heaven? And they're there saying, did I really believe? We don't want to leave those kinds of problems. Second type of problem is, what if the person hasn't believed and doesn't yet understand enough truth? Here we'll have a couple of answers as well. It could either be the name of a girl, the name of a town, or the name of a lake. And the word is Nantali. Nantali on Hurbing County Spini Kalpun Kislow Mason. Now, any answer you put down...
I need more light. The veil's too big.
You're guessing. And quite often people will say, this person's telling me that if I don't decide to believe in Jesus, I will go to the lake of fire. I really don't want to go to the lake of fire. So how do I decide to believe this? Oh, I'll pray the prayer. Oh, okay, well, I'll pray the prayer. But if they don't understand the truth and aren't persuaded of it, that's just throwing up another roadblock and they're not able to believe. It's far better for us to approach things from a more diagnostic standpoint. I'm asking, after having read this passage, what does it tell you about Jesus Christ? What does it say that Jesus Christ gives to people who believe in him? Do you have everlasting life? Person might say, well, I hope so. Well, I hope my works, good works, outweigh my bad works, and all that. Well, you can say, if ever they have understood this, they don't understand it right now. And it's a matter of diagnostically trying to figure out where the person is. Not twisting the arm, but just trying to figure out where they are. Sometimes it's pertinent, if it's someone that we're seeing on a regular basis, to leave them with a question. Maybe come back next week or something like that and follow up. But we don't want the pressure, because when we do that, it only causes people to pull away or to make believe or to become confused. So which mindset is ours? Hopefully we are wanting to see the world in relation to the Word. The Word tells us that it's extremely important now that we are in a time of gleaning to get the message out. But it also tells us that believing is very simple. It's a matter of being persuaded. But we're not the ones that do the persuading. We may ask the questions, we may direct people towards the right passages. We can be helpful, but it's ultimately God who persuades. And so if someone doesn't believe when we're talking to them, don't get a guilt trip. We need to plant the seed. And we need to keep planting seeds. And we need to talk with people and try to see where they are. And that's kind of the direction we're going to be going with this set of Bible studies. Basically looking at things that can help us be a little bolder and a little more accurate in sharing the message. Now, I told you that first part was going to be more complicated than the second part. When we went through my charts, the flow of history, and so forth. What I have in mind for next time, I think will also be something that we'll all be able to grab a hold of. We're going to be working on propitiation. Big word, simple concept.
So in our summary, John, of our memorization verse, the Spirit says come through the Word. We say come by getting the Word out. The unbeliever who's thirsty comes by accepting.
Right. And if he comes, he comes freely.
So the invitation is from the Spirit
and the bride
through us.
Mm-hmm.
So we're part of that vessel that you're talking about.
Yep.
Here to these unbelievers, and we have to remember that if we're nipping at the heels, we're in effect taking away from what the Spirit can do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And maybe preventing the person.
Right. Lots and lots of people struggle over assurance because they either never understood how simple the message is, and that's what we're going to be talking next time about, how simple the message is. The message does not focus on sin. The message does not focus on forgiveness. And the reason it doesn't is because even the unbeliever's sins have been paid for. Their death penalty is paid. But the only people who get everlasting life are those that believe Jesus' first promise. And when we understand how simple the message is, then the Gospel of John makes a lot more sense, because the Gospel of John focuses on the simple message. Believing Jesus Christ for his promise of everlasting life.